Okay, good evening, everyone. It's Parshas Vayishlach, Tavshin, Ayin Tes. We will be beginning from beginning of the Parsha, that's page 170. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanov. And Yaakov sent Malachim before him, El Esav Achiv to Esav, his brother, Arza Seir to the land of Seir, Stay Edom, the field of Edom. So Rashi comments that when it says Yaakov sent Malachim, Rashi says Malachim here, the word Malach can mean messenger. But anytime we talk about a Malach in the sense of an angel, it's because he's a messenger. And in this context, Rashi says the Malachim that Yaakov sent before him were not people, but Malachim Amish, actual angels. The ones that, those who he sent to Esav were not just messengers, they were actual angels. And the question, of course, arises as to why did Yaakov feel it necessary to have to send angels when it would seem he could have sent people. Why did he have to send angels for it?
How can he send angels?
Why not?
I can't send angels.
You can't. But he can.
He can.
As a matter of fact, in the last week's Parsha,
yeah,
he met a bunch of them.
Right. But
they came to meet him. Right, exactly. That's the power of Yaakov.
Hmm.
You bring up a good point. That's the power of Yaakov. Now, the question again, the question is why did Yaakov send actual angels? And as Rabbi Moshe Feinstein adds, you know, if you start basically playing with miracles, when you have a miracle that happens to you, that actually could be a cause for you to lose your mitzvahs. It could be a reason for you to lose your merits. You lose the gains of a mitzvah that you have in reward. You could actually lose them when you have a miracle that's experienced for you. So if Yaakov didn't need the miracle, and he used the miracle, he acted in a miraculous way, in a supernatural way, that would simply be a reason for him to lose his merits, and why would Yaakov want to do that? So Moshe Feinstein, his approach to this whole question, the way I understand it is his principle is the following, that the kind of person that we say would lose his merits when he has miracles happen for him is someone that supernatural miracles makes an impression upon. For someone who basically lives within nature and recognizes nature as the norm, and now he has a miracle, something supernatural occurs for him, so that could be, being that, so number one, it makes, if it makes a bigger impression on him, the fact that it was a supernatural miracle, then that means that to him, nature and miracle are two very different things. And therefore, number one, because they are very different things, Hashem is not going to make miracles happen for him on a consistent basis, because he may stop losing his, it may stop making an impression upon him. He may start thinking it's the normal. If it becomes the norm for him, he's going to look at it as the norm. So therefore, Hashem is not going to do miracles on a regular basis for him. And when he does, because of the fact that it's unusual, it could actually be a reason for him to lose his merits. But when you're talking about Yaakov Avinu, by Yaakov, there is no difference between Nes and Teva. Nature and miracle, there's no difference. By Yaakov Avinu, it's very clear that nature only exists by the will of Hashem. And that our nature, actually, our existence, even in a natural state, is a constant creation. It's a constant creation over and over again of our existence. Being that we don't notice any kind of difference, so they're not impressed about, it doesn't make an impression upon us. But for those who truly understand and live with this idea that even nature is a miracle, because nothing in the world can exist or happen without Hashem's will, and the reason why nature follows its pattern is only because of a constant will, a constant and consistent will of Hashem for it to be that way. So in essence, there's no difference between miracle and nature. It's all the same thing. By Yaakov Avinu, that's very clear. And for someone that it's very clear to the point that there's no difference between a miracle and not a miracle, a miracle, so to speak, doesn't even make an impression upon him, because it's no different than the regular nature around him. For that kind of person is not the person that we say, if he uses a miracle, if he experiences a miracle, then he's going to lose his merits. Why? It's all the same. Miracle, not miracle, nature, regular, abnormal, it's all the same thing. There's no reason that it should have a different, that he should be treated differently because of it. And therefore, there's no big deal if he decides to intentionally use a miracle, like use the angels. Because of the fact that he's the kind of person that since it makes no difference, they're all the same. If it's all the same, well, the same way he can use the natural world, he can use the supernatural world. And Rav Moshe cites a famous Gemara in Meferes Gemara in Tainus. Gemara Tainus talks about Reb Chanina ben Doisa. And the Gemara says that one, it was approaching Shabbos, and he noticed that his daughter was very sad. So he said to his daughter, "What are you so sad about?" So she said, "I made a big blunder. Instead of using olive oil to light the candles, I used vinegar. So these candles aren't going to last too long." And she was very upset about that. On that, Rav Chanina ben Doisa said to her, "Biti, my daughter, what's the difference? Don't worry about it. The same one who tells oil to burn can tell vinegar to burn." And the end of the story is that it burnt the entire day through Havdalah. But the point Rav Chanina ben Doisa was, is that the way he talks, whoever said that the oil will work will say that the vinegar will work. It's all the same thing. There's no difference. Everything that happens in nature is happening because of the Hashem's constant decree that it should be that way. And therefore, if he wants the vinegar to burn, the vinegar will burn. Now, for us, vinegar is not going to burn. But for Chanina ben Doisa, it's going to burn because, again, by him, his perception is so clear about everything is miraculous, everything is being run by Hashem directly, that it makes no difference. So therefore, let's get back to the first question we asked. And to me, Rav Moshe doesn't directly address this question. I mean, Rav Moshe is addressing the question, why would Yaakov use an unnecessary miracle at the cost of losing his chusim, his merits? The answer is, because someone like Yaakov Avinu doesn't lose his merits for a miracle, because nature and miracle are exactly the same thing. But why did Yaakov decide to use the angels? So I would suggest that what Rav Moshe meant was, is that again, Yaakov used the angels because they were there. At the end of the parasha, Yaakov meets the angels. The angels are there. And therefore, Yaakov sees if the angels are there. You know, is there an advantage of using angels over people? We can imagine there is. And therefore, Yaakov decides if he has the angels there, he's going to use the angels. How can he use angels? He's dealing with miracles, not unnecessarily miracles, and he loses the merit because of that? The answer is no. Yaakov doesn't lose the merit for miracles because miracles and nature are all the same to him. The fact that Yaakov used the angels was because there's an advantage using angels, and they were available. And the fact that the Torah is telling us this, I believe, why is the Torah telling us Yaakov said angels? What was the point of that? Especially if, according to Moshe, it sounds like he really didn't need the angels, but he used them. And again, if I understand it correctly, if I understand this approach from Moshe correctly, my understanding would be that the Torah is really bringing out Barry's point, in the sense of Yaakov can use angels. Yaakov has risen to the level that he doesn't just see angels on a ladder, as we had in the beginning of last week's parasha. Yaakov can actually enlist angels to do what he needs.
But maybe he needed angels
to... we can talk about... to me, it seems that Rav Moshe Vine's approach is he didn't necessarily need the angels. But he could use them if he wanted to. And the point, and the Torah is telling us that to show us, again, the greatness of Yaakov, that Yaakov uses angels. He can actually enlist angels to do what he wants. Okay, that would be one approach. The Aruch Chaim approaches the question like this. The Aruch Chaim approaches the question again. He says, why did Yaakov use angels when he seemingly didn't? But Rav Moshe finds it, but the Aruch Chaim has another question. The pasuk reads, "Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lefanav." Yaakov sent angels before him, el Esav achiv, to Esav his brother. If the Torah would have just said el Esav to Esav, would we know it's his brother? Yes. Why does it have to say to Esav his brother? So says the Aruch Chaim, is that this is all coming to explain why was it that Yaakov used angels instead of using people? And the answer that he says is number one. The fact that he met up with the angels at the end, as we find last week's parsha, was a clear sign to Yaakov that if he needed angels, he could use the angels. That's what they were there for, and he could use them for something that they could do over regular people. And for that, he explains this is why the pasuk says Esav his brother, and that is to say that Yaakov had to engage angels for two reasons, because of Esav and because of his brother. And he brings from him Midrashim that we have to understand that Esav at this point of time is nothing to sneeze at. Esav is a very prominent, powerful leader. And therefore, if Yaakov goes ahead, very prominent, very powerful, and if Yaakov goes ahead and sends regular people, Esav may just blow them off. He may even just kill him and then come upon Yaakov without any kind of warning. And therefore, he's sending Malachim because he wants to be that, because according to what Aruch Chaim is learning, Esav doesn't, these are not angels disguised as men, where you think you're looking at a man, but you're looking at an angel. The Aruch Chaim, and this is based on Midrashim also, is that Esav saw angels. Esav didn't just see people, he saw angels. And therefore, when these angels would be the messengers of Yaakov, Esav has to take a couple of steps back. He has to make sure that he receives them, he listens to them, he's not going to kill them because they're angels. And also, it would instill a certain fear in Esav's heart about Yaakov, if Yaakov could send angels. So therefore, the reason why the Torah says Esav, his brother, is because... Oh, wait a second. So first of all, is because, again, number one, it's explaining why he sent angels. Why did he send angels? Because Esav was very powerful. And therefore, to basically intimidate Esav, and make sure Esav receives the messengers, and doesn't do anything to the messengers, he doesn't send people, he sends angels. The reason it says, Achiv, his brother, says the Aruch Chaim, is because what the Torah is trying to explain is now, why is Yaakov going through all of this? Why is Yaakov going through this whole business of extending peace to his brother, humbling himself before his brother? Why is he doing it? And the answer is because it's his brother. And he doesn't say because it's his brother and therefore he's trying to make peace. That's what the Aruch Chaim says. The Aruch Chaim says because it's his brother, he wants to make sure that he doesn't go to war with him. Because he's afraid, Yaakov, that if he goes to war with Esav, you know what's going to protect Esav? Schus av Esav. Yitzchak's marriage. He was concerned that if Esav wages war with Yaakov, that Esav would be able to be, at least, I'm adding, at least partially victorious, because of the schus of Yitzchak, which the Aruch Chaim doesn't elaborate on, but I believe it means, or it could mean, that we know that Esav took care of his father. Esav fulfilled the mitzvah of Kibbut Av more than Yaakov did, and therefore Yaakov is looking, is approaching his brother, trying to make peace with his brother to avoid war, because if he has to now wage war with Esav, he may have to deal with the tzchus of Yitzchak that will be backing, that could be protecting Esav and actually be something that's going to hurt him. So therefore, the Torah said Esav, Achiv, Esav, his brother, because it's trying to teach us, again, number one, why did he send angels? Because it was Esav. Very prominent, very powerful. They don't want to send regular people because Esav may kill them or just blow them off. It says his brother to explain why is Yaakov going through all this trouble of making peace with his brother. Now, another explanation that he gives to why it says Esav his brother is because it's teaching us that when he sent the angels, he sent them to Esav his brother. Again, two categories. Esav his brother. Esav represents Esav a Russia, the evil Russia who hates Yaakov, wants to kill him. Achiv represents his brother, a brother who wants to be a brother, who wants to be at peace with him. Sending the angels, when Yaakov sent the angels to Esav, his brother, that means to bring out that he told the angels, your mission is going to change depending on how you perceive Esav. Will you perceive Esav as Esav HaRasha, and therefore what you have to bring back is one kind of message? If you see him as my brother, then, as you recognize him as my brother, then you need to go ahead and bring me back a message that he's my brother. Therefore, Yaakov sent angels. Because if Esav wants to, Esav could put on this facade that he wants to make big peace with Yaakov. He's all peaceful. He loves Yaakov. And deep down, he's planning on killing him. A human being can't necessarily see through that. But an angel can. And apparently, it's an interesting idea. Because, you would think that maybe there are some people who could do that. Great people who are able to penetrate, look in people and read people without in a very unique way. You know, there are great people who could look at people... There are great tzaddikim who look at people and know what was going on with them. But again, it could very well have been here that Esav is a very unique individual. He's not your simple individual. And it's something that Yaakov felt that any kind of human being would not be able necessarily to penetrate the facade that Esav would put on. And therefore, he sent angels to do so. But he's sending the angels to be able to see, is Esav being an Esav in the sense that he hates me and wants to kill me? Or is Esav being a brother and he actually wants peace? That is what the angels have to determine. Okay.
But does that mean Yaakov doesn't have enough amunah and so forth?
Why?
He's looking to Esav. Right away he's saying, I'm afraid of Esav.
He didn't say he's afraid of Esav. He's right away trying to figure out how to deal with him.
Deal with him, but that means he doesn't...
Deal, he has to deal. Right? We all have to put in our hishtadlis, our efforts of how we do things. Okay, now, next pasuk. Pasuk hey. Vayitzav Esav Lamar, and he commanded them to say, Koysomu v'adoni l'Esav, so shall you say to my master, to Esav. Koy amar avdecha Yaakov, so says your servant Yaakov, im Laban garti, I lived with Laban, v'eicharet ata, and that is where I stayed until now. Vayili sharba chamaratzim v'eme v'shivcha, and I have oxen, donkeys, sheep, men slaves, maid servants, veshcha lahagi ladeini, and I am now sending to tell my master, limtzeichei meinech, to find favor in your eyes. So how do we understand this message when he says, so says your servant, Yaakov, I have lived with Laban until now. What's he trying to convey to Esav? What is it important for him to know this? Why is it important for him to mention this to Esav? So Rashi has a famous explanation that actually im Laban garti, when Yaakov is sending a message, I lived with Laban, he means to say, I lived with Laban, I kept all the mitzvahs, Laban had no influence on me, he didn't tear me down, didn't bring me down, and therefore I don't think that now I have lost the merits of the blessings that Yitzchak gave and that you can now have control over me. The Aruch Chaim explains it like this. The Aruch Chaim explains that the point of Imlovan Garti Vayacharata, he first says, his first explanation is that when you have someone that you're close with, you want to show someone that you trust him, that you trust him, and you want to confide in him. When you have someone that you're very close with that you haven't seen in a long time, so what do? You let him know what's going on with you. You tell him what's going on. You may even say certain personal things to him. Because he's important to you. He's special to you. He's someone that you want to share what's happened to you. You want to share what's happened to you with him. Yaakov, by saying to Esav, I live with Laban, and I was there until now, it's all about Yaakov showing Esav, I want to let you know what's been going on with me. It was really another act of brotherhood, another act of showing that Yaakov wants to be good, wants to be a brother with Esav. Therefore, he starts telling him what's going on with him in a sense of, look, you know, you're my brother. I love you. You're an important person. You're a special person to me. And therefore, I want to let you know what's going on. That's one explanation he gives. The other explanation he gives of Imlovan Garti is, again, similar to Rashi, but not exactly the same thing. And it is in which Yaakov is trying to convince Esav a couple of things. He's trying to convince Esav from different angles that don't make war with me. Don't make war with me. Not as a threat, but actually through good things. Firstly, Thomas says, Imlovan Garti. I live with Lovin. You know what it's like to live with Lovin? You know what it's like to live with Lovin. Lovin is a snake. Lovin is not someone you want to live with. You know, he's the kind of person the Gemara says, get away from him fast. But I lived with him, and I survived him. And therefore, you can see what kind of person I am. And he's not trying to boast. He's trying to say to Esav, you know, you can see if I could survive living with Lovin, I'm a good person. I'm not out to get anybody, not out to hurt anybody. And therefore, we should be getting along. That's what Imlovan Garti. Now, va'echaradata, and I stayed until now. That's to say to Esav, well, you know, I know you live with Lovin, but how long were you there for? Va'echaradata. The answer is, I've been there for 20 years. I've been there for a long time, and I still made it. Then Esav might say, now the next thing Yaakov says is, va'hili shar v'chamar tzayin v'v'shivcha, and I have lots of animals, and tzayin v'v'shivcha. The reason why this is something that he's conveying to Esav, says the Aruch Chaim, is because Esav might say, all right, 20 years by Esav. You were schlepper by Esav for 20 years. You were schlepper by Esav for 20 years. And he says, no. Not Esav, Laban, I'm sorry. You were schlepper by Laban. He says, no. I have Sayyid of Shivcha. I survived Lebanon. I came out a wealthy man. Okay? And even so, I call you my master. And even so, I want to be at peace with you. I have of all these things, and I want you to have it just like I have it. It's all part, again, of Yaakov's efforts to show Esau he wants to be at peace. Like, I'm not just a schlepper. I came out of there very, very successful. And still, I want to be at peace with you, and I want to be, and I want no problems with you. So it's all part, says the Aruch Chaim. Everything in this pasuk is all pressing upon Esav, limtzachein beinecha, to find favor in your eyes. It's all about trying to show you that I'm at peace and I want to be at peace. Okay, now we're up to pasuk Zion. Pasuk Zion reads, Vayashuvu hamalachim el Yaakov lemar. And the messengers returned to Yaakov saying, Banu elachicha leisav. We have come to your brother Esav, to Esav. The Gamalech Likrascha, and he's also coming to greet you. Barabimir's Ish Imoy with 400 men with you. Okay, so here again, they say to Yaakov, we came to your brother to Esav, right? It says, to your brother to Esav. It's also interesting that when Yaakov, the Pasuk before in Pasuk Dal, it says, Yaakov sent angels to Esav, his brother. When the angels come back, they say, to your brother to Esav. And therefore, says the Aruch Chaim, the message was like this. We came to your brother. He's acting like your brother. He's so happy to hear about you. El Esav. But we recognize deep down he's Esav. He's coming to greet you. Yeah, he's coming to meet you. He wants to reunite. Again, acting like a brother. He's bringing 400 men. It's not just an escort. It's not just an escort. It's an army. So therefore, the angels fulfilled their mission of seeing through the facade and letting Yaakov know what's really going on. Let's continue. Page 172, Pasuk Ches. Vayira Yaakov, Ma'od Vayetzer Lo. And Yaakov was very scared, and he was distressed. Okay. Vayachsam Asher Itay, and he split the nation that was with him, and the sheep and the cattle and the camels into two camps. So the pasuk says Yaakov was fearful and he was distressed. So if you look in the top Rashi, which is the top of the right column in Rashi, Vayira Vayetzer, what are these two things? He was fearful, he was distressed. So it says Vayira Shema Yehareik, he was fearful, perhaps he will be killed. Vayetzer Loi Imyaruku Esacherim, and he was distressed if he kills others. So this second half needs explanation. He was distressed if he's after to kill others. I mean, they're coming to kill him. If somebody comes to kill you, you don't say, you know, okay, go ahead. You have to protect yourself. So what is Yaakov distressed about? Maybe he's going to go ahead and kill others. What's the problem? He has to protect himself. Why should he be distressed over that? So you might say that even so, it's a distressing thing. Just the whole idea is a distressing thing. So the Sifzei Chachamim brings down two explanations. One explanation is based on Medrash Tanchuma, which is really interesting, because Medrash Tanchuma says is that Yaakov was afraid he may end up killing Esav. And if he kills Esav in war, that is going to upset his father Yitzchak very much. Because Yitzchak, according to the way the Sifzei Chachamim brings down the Tanchuma, Yitzchak still thinks Esav is a kosher. It's almost like, according to this, Yitzchak still doesn't recognize who Esav is. He may recognize that Yaakov should have gotten the blessings, but he doesn't necessarily, he still thinks Esav is kosher. Esav's not necessarily a big person, but he's kosher. Kosher means he's okay. He's not evil. He's okay. And if Yaakov kills him, that may be very distressing to Esav, to Yitzchak, over the fact that Esav, who was, in his mind, a proper person, was killed by his brother. And he's afraid that maybe Yitzchak is going to curse him. If Yaakov lands up cursing Esav, Yitzchak may curse Yaakov. Now, I think the explanation, I'm sharing the explanation because it's an interesting explanation, especially in the sense of the fact that the Tanchum is saying that Yitzchak still thinks Esav is kosher, to the point that he would be upset if there was a war and Yaakov killed him, that he would curse Yaakov. Why would he curse Yaakov? I mean, who started the war? Exactly. But okay, that's one explanation the Sifzcham brings down. Another explanation the Sifzcham brings down is a more of a halachic one, which I think is very interesting also, very novel. And that is that we know that if somebody comes to kill you, kill him back, right? If he's trying to kill you, protect yourself. You have to kill him, you kill him. Now, the halacha is also, let's say you see somebody trying to kill someone else. You're also allowed to go ahead and stop the killer from killing someone else by killing him if you need to. I can't hear you. Right. Now, the thing is, though, is that when it comes to that, there's a very important rule, and that is, if you're protecting someone else from being killed, if you could shoot the guy in the leg and not kill him, that's what you have to stop. But if you can't stop him that way, then you can kill him. But you're only allowed to kill him if the only way to stop him from killing someone else is by killing him. If you could have stopped him otherwise and you killed him, you're liable for murder. So the Simcha Chachamim says the Yaakov's concern was like this. Maybe, this is the way he lays it out. Maybe Esav is going to come with his army, they're going to attack. Esav is going to decide, going to say to his army, boys, you take care of the other people. Yaakov's mine. Which means it's Esav is coming to kill Yaakov. Esav's men are not coming to kill Yaakov. Coming to kill other people. Okay, so Yaakov has to deal with Esav. Esav's coming to kill him. He can kill him to protect himself. But now Yaakov also is going to try to save other people. When he's trying to save other people from Esav's men, he has to be able to determine each time that instead of killing him, he has to determine, do I need to kill him or can I just wound him? And Yaakov is afraid that he may end up killing somebody that could have wounded and he'll be liable for murder. That was his distress. He was distressed that if Esav's men are not coming to kill him, but to kill others, so now he's got to make sure that the way to save the other people is only by killing Esav's men. Then he's afraid he may make a mistake where he could have stopped them just by wounding them, and he killed them, and he's liable for their murder. Now, I find this explanation difficult only because of the fact that means that during an actual war, you have to go ahead and do that. Which, I can't say that I know the halachas about this enough, but it just seems odd that, you know, if you see somebody, a guy is chasing after someone to kill him, all right, you got to determine, pop him in, you know, shoot him in the leg, or kill him. But in the middle of a war, you have to figure out, in the middle of a war, you can only for sure kill the guy coming at you, but to protect someone else who's getting killed, you have to figure it out? Maybe, I don't know, it just seems that in the middle of a war, that's a difficult thing to do. Okay, now, so that's the Simcha Chachamim's explanation. The explanation given by, right, there's another explanation given, a very interesting explanation. And we have discussed this, we've discussed this idea many times before. And that is, the idea is like this. Murder is a bad thing, right? It's clearly an act with strong potential for bad. It's something that's typically bad. But sometimes you got to do it. You have to kill Amalek. You have to kill someone who's coming to kill you. We know there's something called Iran Nidachas, a city that has to be wiped out because of worshipping idols. When you engage in an act that we'll call typically evil, even if that act you were allowed to do, and even if it was a mitzvah to do, it still leaves its mark on you. An act, a violent act, an act that is an act of, that's typically an act of evil, an act that really inherently is evil. But sometimes you're allowed to do it, and sometimes you even have a mitzvah to do it. All right, you're not going to get an aveira. It's not an aveira. It's not a sin if you do it. But the facts are, doing such an act leaves its mark on you. Anytime an act like that happens, it leaves a mark on you. If a person, chas v'shalom, hurts someone, number one, he hurts someone, and number two, it leaves an impression on you. You become a harder person, a more difficult person, a more cruel person. And therefore, Yaakov's concern is that if he kills Esav, yes, he's allowed to kill Esav. And maybe he's allowed to kill Esav's men. But what's that going to do to him as a person? What kind of mark is that going to leave on him? Because when you engage in an act that is inherently evil, just that, or typically evil, whichever word you're going to use, but and even if now you're allowed to do it, or even now it's a mitzvah to do it, it can leave. It leaves a negative impact on you. That's what Esav was very, very, very distressed about. I'm going to share you a very interesting story that I heard. I was listening to a shiur from a rabbi in Flatbush. His name is Rabbi Daniel Usher Kleiman, and he said this explanation, I believe I've heard the explanation in other places also, seen in other places also, but he gave this explanation. And he told a very interesting story with his Rebbe, who is my Rebbe, which is Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky. We didn't learn in Philadelphia Yeshiva together. He's much younger than me. But I studied under Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky. He studied. He actually very close to Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky. And he said the following story, that he knows of someone that got involved in a machlekes, a dispute, a very serious one. But he came to the side of the person who was right. You know, very often, of course, there's two sides to a story, but, you know, you have situations where one side is right, one side is wrong, and one side needs to be helped. So you land up joining the dispute to really stand up and protect the person who needs protection, which means you didn't do anything wrong. You did the right thing. And this person he knows got involved in such a situation, helping someone who needed. He was right for getting involved, was on the right side of the argument, and he was involved. So I don't know if it was Shana Yom Kippur. I'm assuming it was probably Yom Kippur. Maybe I don't remember all the details. But this man, this person approached Shmuel Kamenetsky about, on Yom Kippur, as Yom Kippur was beginning. He went over to Rosh Hashiva and he said to Rosh Hashiva, he's been thinking about what does he need to work on for the coming year? You know, when it comes to Shana Yom Kippur, you're trying to think about what you should be working on. So Shmuel told him he has to work on machlekes. He has to work on not getting involved in arguments. So he was taken back. He assumed Shmuel was saying that it was wrong for him to get involved. And he said, Shiva feels that it was wrong for me to get involved in that dispute. He says, no. It was right to get involved in a dispute. But if you get involved in a dispute, being in a dispute leaves a negative influence. It leaves a negative mark. So you now have to work on making sure that it didn't leave that mark and the negative influence on you, and make sure you don't get involved in arguments, because you now have that influence on you because you got involved. It wasn't wrong for you to get involved. It was right for you to get involved. You should have gotten involved. But now that you're involved, it leaves its effect. And therefore, you have to deal with it. You have to make sure it doesn't take you in the wrong direction. And that is what Yaakov was distressed with over here. Perhaps he will kill someone else, and that will leave a negative mark on him. Okay. Now, let's read on a little bit more. Pasuk tes, Vayomer. After the Pasuk just said that Yaakov divided up his whole family into two camps, Vayomer, and he said, Im yavoy Esav alamachna achas v'hiko, if Esav comes to one camp and smites it, v'yamachna anisha lefaleta, the other camp will remain to be saved. Now, Vayomer Yaakov, Elokei Avi Avraham, Yaakov said, the God of my father Abraham, Elokei Avi Yitzchak, the God of my father Yitzchak. Hashem Ho'imer Eilai, God who said to me, Shuv La'artzecho Baratecha, return to your land and to your birthplace, Ve'tiva Imach, and I will do good with you. Katointi Mikol Achasadim Mikol Ha'emes, I have become small from all the kindnesses and from all the truth. Asher Asisas Avdech, that you have done with your servant. Kiva Makli Avati Es Hayardin Hazeh, I crossed over this Jordan just with my stick, but I become two camps. So Rashi explains that when Yaakov says, I have become small from all the kindnesses, Rashi says that means nismatu zechuyosai, my merits again have become diminished, through the kindnesses and the truth that you have done with me. Yaakov Avinu was saying, you've done so much for me, so much kindnesses for me. I'm concerned that I don't have any schutzim left. I've used up my schutzim because of all your kindnesses. And look at the kindness. I started with nothing. I only had a stick. Now I'm two camps. That is an unbelievable kindness that I am concerned that I've lost my merits. That's how Rashi explains. Clearly, Yaakov was saying to Rabbeinu Shalom that I am unworthy of requesting you to save me, because I have become so small, my merits have become so small from all the kindness and the truth that you have done. So there's two things here. Number we have to discuss. Number one, from all the kindness and from all the truth. What does truth mean here? Kindness isn't truth. What does truth got to do with anything over here? What does truth mean?
Showing the right way of thinking.
Okay, perhaps. That's an interesting idea. Another question that the Ar HaChaim asks is that the way he understands emes is that, you know, the Ribbono Shel Olam rewards us for our actions. He treats us accordingly according to our actions, right? The Ribbono Shel Olam knows how to calculate what we deserve for our actions. So the emes you would have expected to have meant, says the Ar HaChaim, that emes should mean, truth means what I deserve, and chasadim means beyond what I deserve. So katayinti mikala emes means I become small from what you've already given me, what I've deserved for my actions, and what you've given me beyond what I deserve. But if that's what it means, then it should say emes before chesed. It should say I become small from the truth and the kindness, not the kindness and the truth. Emes, what you deserve comes before what goes beyond what you deserve. So if Yaakov, if the word emes here means to talk about the way that Yaakov, to some level, deserves what he has received, then that should go first. So therefore, says the Ar HaChaim, it doesn't mean that. But we have a concept, we have a term called chesed shel emes, which is a term that's used when you take care of the dead. It's called a kindness of truth. What do you mean kindness of truth? It means, very often, when a person does a chesed, does a kindness, in the back of his mind, I'm helping you so that you'll help me. There's a certain thought of payback. When you are kind, when you give, when you do for someone that's deceased, not going to expect any kindness back from him. Now, you could argue, well, maybe think about kindness to somebody else. But at the same time, there's a certain level of truth, meaning, you know, it's a kindness in the truest sense. That's what a chesed shel emes means. A kindness of truth means a kindness of the truest sense. Because a kindness is supposed to be where I'm giving through you and it's all about you, not about me. The kind of kindness that really you can say that occurs, the most selfless kind of kindness, the truest kind of kindness where you're just doing for the other person with no thought of return, is when you're kind with someone who passes away. The same idea can be related to when Hashem does kindness with us. When Hashem does kindness with us, does he expect payback? There is no payback. He's the Ribbono Shel Olam. There's nothing to pay back for the Ribbono Shel Olam with. And even if there, and that's on one sense. At another level, whatever kindness he has done for us, we can never pay him back. The kindnesses the Ribbono Shel Olam for us are so great, as we say in Davening every Shabbos, that nothing that we could ever do could pay back for the kindnesses he's done for us. So, when Yaakov Avinu refers to the kindnesses of Hashem, he says, from the kindnesses, from the truth. It's not two separate things. It really means, I become small from the kindnesses of truth. Your kindnesses, Rav Shalom, are kindnesses of truth. When you do a kindness with someone, there's no payback. There's no expectation of payback. There is no payback. It's not possible to pay back. And therefore, Hashem's kindnesses are the most truthful kindnesses. And this is what Yaakov is declaring. Ribbono Shel Olam, I have become small from your kindnesses of truth, your truthful kindnesses. Your kindnesses that there's no way to pay back because they're so immense, they're so great. And I have become small because of that. Yaakov does not mean to mention to Ribbono Shel Olam, look, I have done all these things, I deserve something. That's not what Yaakov means. Yaakov is recognizing the Ribbono Shel Olam's kindnesses with him are all kindnesses of truth. They cannot be paid back. They can't. None of them can be paid back. And I recognize that, Yaakov says. And because of that, maybe my merits have become small. And that's what Yaakov means, says the Ar HaChaim. Chesed mikol emes is not two things. It's really a way of explaining this, the chesed. The chesed of Hashem is a chesed in the truest sense. Because there is no payback to Hashem's kindness.
The way we live.
Well, we see it as paying him back, but we're not actually paying him back. We feel it's a payback of sorts. He lets us feel it's a payback of sorts, but it's not truly a payback. Now, this is what Yaakov is saying. Now, what this also teaches us is a tremendous thing in the way Yaakov looks at his life. You know, Yaakov has gone through so much for the past 20 years. Yaakov had to work 14 years for his wives. When he worked for Esav, I'm sorry, for Lavan, I keep saying that. When he worked for Lavan, it's very clear, as Yaakov said, he worked himself to the bone. And he took every loss. He did everything to work to his fullest, with the greatest faithfulness to Lavan. No question. The most dedicated, loyal work. For who? For Lavan. For Lavan, who constantly changed his wages so as to prevent Yaakov from getting his wages. Yaakov went through a lot. Yaakov should clearly be the person who he says he pulled up the strap of his boots, he pulled them up by his bootstraps, and he made something of himself. That's the kind of person who typically looks at what they've done and pat themselves on the back. We actually tell them something, they should pat themselves on the back. Look how hard you worked, you persevered, and that's where you succeeded. Yaakov Avinu does not look at himself like that. He could have, but Yaakov says, "Kantoiti mikol achasadim, mikol emes." Everything that I have had, the fact that I went from a stick to two camps, is not because I persevered. Yeah, I had to persevere. That's what I had to do. But that's not why I am where I am. It's all chasadim shel emes. It's all your kindnesses, Rabbi Shalom. Yaakov Avinu is telling, is giving us such an important lesson that as much as perseverance and hard work is something that we clearly need to do, there's no question about that. But at the end of the day, if you succeed with all that, your ability to persevere, your ability to succeed, is all Hashem's kindness. And Yaakov recognizes that to the point that he's afraid that he has actually lost his merits to be saved from his brother Esav. Okay. Now, we're going to skip a few pages. And we're going to go to page 180, Perek Lamedal Pasuk Aleph, which is the story of when Dina was kidnapped by Shechem and violated. So, as we know, it says that Dina was abducted by Shechem. He violated her. He wanted to marry her. Yaakov heard about it. He didn't say anything until his sons come back. His sons come back. They're very upset about how, basically, Dina was violated and she's been kidnapped. And they try to be able to get her released by making a plan together, making a plan, telling Shechem and his father Hamor, you know, if you want us, if you want to marry our daughter, you know, we can all become one big happy family if you decide to have a bris milah. And they thought that they'd never do it. But Shechem was so, he wanted so much to marry Dina that him and Hamor, they convinced the people of their town to go ahead and get a bris. So now, let's take a look on page 184, Pasuk Chaf Hei, which is 2, 4, 6 lines from the top of the page. So the Pasuk reads, and this is Pasuk Chaf Hei, verse 25, Vayi Vayei Mashlishi, and it was on the third day, Vayei Sam Kayabim, and they were all in tremendous pain. Vayikhu Shnei B'nei Yaakov V'shimun V'levi Yachei Dina Ishkarbai. And the two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dina, took his sword. Vayavalayir betach, they came upon the city secure. Vayarga kol zachar, and they wiped out every male. Okay, famous story of how Shimon and Levi destroyed Shechem to free their sister. We know at the end Yaakov wasn't too happy about it. Now the Medrash points out, asks the following question. The Medrash has bothered the following question. If the Pasuk would have just said, and Shimon and Levi took their sword and killed, we know they're the sons of Yaakov. We don't need the Torah to tell us that they're the sons of Yaakov. Why does it say that? Why does it say they're the brothers of Dina? So in that Rashi says, because they put their lives out for her, and therefore they're called her brothers. But why do we have to know that, why do we have to call Shimon and Levi the two sons of Yaakov? We know they're the two sons of Yaakov. Why is it necessary to say that? So the Medrash says like this. The reason it says they are the sons of Yaakov is really to say, although they were the sons of Yaakov, they didn't act like the sons of Yaakov because they didn't speak it over with Yaakov first. Shimon and Levi went ahead on their own and made this decision without asking their father Yaakov. And this is being pointed out by saying they are the sons of Yaakov. It's really like trying to say they're the sons of Yaakov and they still didn't act like the sons of Yaakov by asking their father what to do. Why does it say Shnei Bnei Yaakov, the two sons of Yaakov? You could say, and the sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, went ahead and took their sword. Why does it say the two sons of Yaakov? And that the Medrash says, it's trying to say they're two, to say that they were separate. they didn't discuss this plan with each other either. Basically, each one of them decided to pick up a sword and go kill Shechem. And I'm sure at one point they bumped into each other and said, "Hey, where are you going?" And they told, and he said, "Where are you going?" But it's not like when they decided to do this, they talked it over first. They clearly were in agreement, but they never discussed it on their own. Each one on his own decided to do it, and then apparently, then I would assume they joined up together when, that's my assumption, they joined up together when they realized what they were both doing or planning on doing, but they never discussed it together. And the fact that according to the Medrash, the Torah is bringing this out, it's not a compliment. It's a criticism. It's a criticism of Reuven, of Shimon and Levi, that number they didn't ask their father, which we can understand, the criticism of that. What's the criticism, though, of, what's the point, though, of saying, and they didn't ask each other? I mean, you see that they were in agreement. They both did the same thing. And even when Yaakov rebukes them, they answer the same thing. So they're in sync. Why did they need to talk it over? And the answer is a very important lesson. Very important lesson. This Rabbi Kleiman also pointed out. Very important lesson. And that is that before you do something, talk it over with someone. Talk it over. You know, you never know what talking over with someone else is going to do. And even if, like, you know, I think this, oh, I agree too. When two people work over something together, things happen. You know, you talk things over together with someone, you talk it out, you speak it out, each person goes ahead and maybe, you know, challenges you, whatever it may be. Always having someone to talk over something as clearly important as this is a very important thing. Don't rush. Now again, I'm not saying that, you know, actually they rushed into it. They could have on their own thought through, but they didn't talk it over with each other. That's the way I would say it. They didn't talk it over with each other.
The other 10 brothers, they had no idea
about anything? No, not about that. They thought they did the plan with the bris. The idea of killing, the other brothers weren't involved. Now these two brothers, they were Shimon and Levi, they're brothers, right? They are brothers. They're close with each other. We know that. We'll know that. We'll see that even more later on in the coming parashas. These were people. These were the, when each one of them decided and made this very big decision to go do something, they could have. This was something that they should have discussed with each other. You know, you didn't want to go talk to your father about it. All right, but with each other, with a friend, with a confidant. That at least they should have done. It was bad enough they didn't talk to their father. At least before they went ahead and made a decision, they should have talked it over with each other. Rabbi Kleiman actually calls it that they rushed into it. I'm not sure if you have to say they rushed into it as much as just saying, you know, yeah, it was a rush in the sense that even if they deliberated on their own, they should have deliberated with each other. And that is an important thing. Again, clearly, this teaches us not to rush into things, right? Even when you're thinking about something on yourself, don't rush into things. And not only don't rush into things, even after you've deliberated, still don't go further. Still deliberate further by talking to someone else. So Rabbi Kleiman said a very interesting story again about the other Philadelphia Rosh Yeshiva, our Rebbe, Rabbi Yishmael Zatzal. And this wasn't an exact story about talking with someone else, but again, it was the idea of being deliberate. Don't rush into something. As important as it may be, don't rush into something. And here, too, there was something going on. There was some kind of issue going on. And people's reaction was, something has to be done about this. Something has to be done. So Rebellia gave a mushel. Imagine there's a fire. You see a house on fire. Something's got to be done. You see this jug of something, and you run over, and you throw it on the fire. And guess what it was? Gasoline. And you know what? For a second, when the gasoline hits, the fire may stop for a second, but then it gets even worse. But there, the point where you're at, your reaction was, something's got to be done. There's a fire there. Something's got to be done. Someone's got to do something about it. Okay? All right. Somebody's got to do something about it, but you got to make sure not to actually make it worse by rushing into it. Decisions, especially important ones, big decisions, need deliberation. They need liberation in the sense that not to rush into something on your own, and liberation, even if you have thought it over, talk it over with someone else.
But sometimes you don't have the time.
Could be. That could be. Now, let's go, let's see, let's take a look at something else here that relates to this. Let's go back to page 182. And on page... No, actually on page 180. This is page 180, Pasuk Hey, four lines from the bottom. The Yaakov Shema, Yaakov heard, Kitime Esina Bitai, that he had violated in his daughter. Uvanav Hayu Es Mikneo Basadeh, and his sons were with the cattle in the field. The Echer is Yaakov Adboyam. Yaakov remained silent until they came. The Torah stresses Yaakov remained silent until they came. Says the Sefornu, why did Yaakov stay silent until they came? Because Yaakov realized that before he goes to confront Shechem and Hamor, the smartest way to do that is with his sons, because like they're protected. You know, 12 people are better than one. It was really a way of Yaakov holding off from going to basically, you know, confront Shechem and Hamor by waiting for the brothers. Now, the Sefornu would seem to imply, and from the fact that the Pasuk is stressing this, is that the expectation would have been that Yaakov would immediately have done something. He heard what happened to his daughter, he'd immediately go do something about it. And the Pasuk says, no, he didn't. He actually waited till his sons came because it would be better for him to confront them with his sons. There are, the Sefornu comments on the next pasuk that says Vayetzi Chamar v'Yishchem el Yaakov, that Chamar, the father of Yishchem, went out to Yaakov. Why did Chamar go out to Yaakov? Because he was wondering, how come I haven't seen Yaakov yet? He was expecting Yaakov already to be here, and if Yaakov wasn't here, he was afraid that Yaakov was plotting something, and therefore he went in and preempted Yaakov. So clearly the fact that Yaakov didn't react right away here seems to be something unusual. So the Torah says, but he remained silent until his sons came. His sons were in the cattle, and he remained silent until they came. Says the Sefornu, he didn't react right away because he figured it's smarter to go ahead and react to do with his sons. Hamor goes ahead and approaches Yaakov because he's surprised that Yaakov hasn't come to confront him yet. Why is the Torah telling us this? Why does the Torah have to tell us Yaakov remained silent, waited for his sons? Why does it have to tell us this? And I think the answer would be, following this idea, is that Yaakov, as much as this terrible thing had happened, and the expectation is that he should immediately react and confront Shechem and Hamor, he was deliberate. He thought it through. Probably better for me to go ahead and wait for, it's better for me to wait for my sons before I do anything. So as much as he would want to do something, and that was the normal thing to do, to react right away, Yaakov was deliberate. He thought it through. He didn't rush into things because he knew that was the best way to go. This is an example of someone in a situation where, you know, you would have thought, you know, maybe it's not time to be deliberate. It's not expected to be deliberate. You should right away go ahead and deal with them. Yaakov is deliberate. He's thinking it through, making sure that he does it in the right way.
He said he heard it. How did he hear it?
I know. What's the answer? How exactly did he hear it?
Yeah.
I don't have an answer to that right now. I don't remember the answer. Okay, have a good night.
Thank you, Rabbi. A lot of family dynamics.
A lot of family dynamics, yeah.
Things that have changed.